If the question is social justice work the work of the church, I know that almost all of you will answer, well, of course it is. That's why we give to the Elizabeth Fry Society with our collection monies and so many other things. Well, I have known folks who have quit a Unitarian church because they did not agree. Most of us do this. Is social justice work the work of individual Unitarians? Again, many of you understand that, yes, this is your work, and you do it. Whether by distributing food at the food bank, which we do every couple of weeks, or by doing advocacy work on various issues like affordable housing or Amnesty International, or helping fund educational opportunities for those less fortunate. You consider social justice work living out our principles of justice, equity, and fairness, and compassion for others. My question today is about why you or I might do social justice work or work in your community, like the Ag Advisory Committee, or helping out with the electoral campaign. How many are set to go with the election campaign? Several of us, yes. What is the deeper meaning we ascribe to these activities? The prophets of old were summoned by God to do this kind of work. Imagine the scene. Jonah's hanging out at home, taking it easy, when suddenly, out of nowhere, he hears this voice. Go, go to the city of Nineveh. I need you to tell them they are not living right. It has come to my attention that they are being wicked. Jonah knows full well that no one wants to hear the admonishments of a prophet. Who wants to be told to spend less time on Facebook or less time watching Canucks games so they can spend more time helping out at the food bank and going to the Pocomo Youth Society board meetings? Who wants to be told they need to tithe to the church and sit through interminable committee meetings to make the church work? Not Jonah. So Jonah takes off on a boat trip, a cruise maybe. He pays his fare and takes off. But you can't run away from this kind of call. God follows him and makes the passage so rough that Jonah confesses. He begs the sailors to throw him overboard. Well, you know, the sailors don't want to give up on this guy. They throw out some stuff first. But finally, they realize they have to go along with the idea. And of course, then the water calms down. And that's when the big fish or the whale, whichever version you want to believe, comes along and gobbles him up. Finally, Jonah relents after several days inside, says, okay, okay, I'll go. And Jonah is released and does as he must do. It is a relief to be doing what you know you have to do, after all. Nobody really wants to be a prophet. It can be a lonely business. So why do people bother with such thankless and unending, daunting tasks? Professor Kaylin Northcutt, a preacher's teacher, tells the story of how she was initiated into the work of God. This is her language, so I will use it. She was 9 years old, and it was a Saturday, springtime. Her mother had them up early, house cleaning. Her dad was running the vacuum, and Kay and her two sisters were in charge of dusting, emptying trash cans, stripping the beds, cleaning their rooms, shining the mirrors. Just as she was about to escape into her Saturday freedom, her mother hollered from the other end of the house, Kaylin, quick, run the compost out to the compost pile. Kay says that her mother was the queen of compost way before composting was cool. She collected kitchen scraps all week in a stainless steel mixing bowl, old potato peelings, eggshells, coffee, tea grounds. It was a mess. Slimy, sticky, stinky. And it had to be carried across 3 acres to the back of the property to be dumped into the compost pile. You can just see her struggling not to tip it, right? Kay tells the story. As I walked past my mother on my way out the back door, the bowl of rotting scraps under my nose, I told Mom that it might interest her to know that my best friend Audrey Barnum and her three brothers are this very minute watching the monkeys on TV and eating sugar pops by the handfuls right out of the box. This is what normal kids do on Saturday mornings. And then Kay adds this stinger. I didn't ask to be born into this family. Well, her mother was not at a loss for words. That's right. You didn't ask to be here. God and I invited you here to make the world a better place, which requires hard work. So get moving to that compost pile. Kay remembers that moment as the beginning of her call to action, her call to a vocation, where her life and God's purpose intersected. Now use the language you are fluent in. Maybe the call to the world to make the world a better place comes from God or your mother or from that still small voice within or from an innate sense of fairness for the world or a sense of compassion for those less fortunate. It doesn't matter what language you speak. It is a call to be a prophet. Today, I invite you to consider the work of making the world a better place, which I know many of you do in varying degrees from a smidgen to a whole lot, as a spiritual practice. What you are doing is not only for the purpose of improving the world, making it a tiny step closer to being the kingdom of God, but it is also a means of enriching your own life, a pathway to deepening your spirituality, your connectedness to the rest of the world. There are few things we do only because it's a good thing to do. Altruism is rarely so pure. We are so much more likely to continue doing something good if we get something out of it too. Over the long haul, to stay in it for the long haul, we need to get something out of it too. So what do I mean by a spiritual practice? Author Scott Alexander writes that what makes an everyday activity into a spiritual practice is intentionality, regularity, and depth. Intentionality, regularity, and depth. It is your commitment to making this activity a regular and significant part of your life that makes it a practice that deepens your spirit. Having some structure as to when and how you do it encourages you to continue to be regular about it. Reflection on how and why it is in your life gives it the depth. Our practices may change over time, as we change, as our circumstances change. Alexander's collection of essays on what Unitarian Universalists consider their spiritual practice reveals a huge scope of things. They engage the mind, the body, the heart, the will, the soul. Each path has many possibilities. Engaging the mind is reflective exercises, silent retreats, mindfulness, reading, prayer. Now, that's what I would have considered a spiritual discipline before I looked at this book. I hadn't thought about all these other possibilities. Several contributors write about engaging the body, activity as spiritual discipline, from running to yoga to martial arts. I thought it was very interesting. The article on yoga was written by a guy, and the article on martial arts was written by a woman. I now deem my twice-weekly paddles on the Fraser River as my spiritual discipline. Yes, it is my exercise. Yes, it is a social time with friends when we gather at the coffee shop afterwards. But now that I consider this activity to be my spiritual discipline, I am much more mindful. I am aware of what is going on around me during my time on the water. Is the tide going in or out? Is the water high or low? Has the spring freshet begun yet? It's been raining, so the river is a bit fuller than usual. The tide is high, but I can't tell whether it's coming or going. And just what is the weather this minute? Well, the sun is peeking out from all the clouds, but Mount Baker is still hiding, as it so often does. I wonder if we will see the pair of eagles that nest just upstream of Fort Langley. Will we see a blue heron or a seal? We do sometimes. It lifts my spirits to be out on the water, and I marvel at the beauty of the new-fallen snow on the North Shore Mountains and the sun on the water. I am grateful for the opportunity to be able to do this so often, so easily. I am mindful of my good fortune. Paddling connects me more deeply with myself, with other people, and the natural world especially. It nourishes my soul. The time I spend on the river enhances the rest of my life. I find I am more whole and can engage more fully in all of my work and my world. My relationships are renewed and strengthened. There are any number of disciplines that can be named as spiritual. My intent today is not to enumerate them. What I do wish to do is to open your eyes to seeing the social justice work that you may already be doing as a spiritual discipline, and to ask you, how does this work, when you see it as a discipline, affect you? Does it change you in any way? As you know, we are now in election mode here in Canada. I know that many of you are involved in the process, helping out at various capacities at various levels. I invite you to be mindful over the next few weeks. What has drawn you into the campaign this time? What relationships are important to you? What tasks do you find difficult, but what keeps you going through them anyway? Perhaps most importantly, I ask the question, what do you get out of your participation in the election process? And I don't mean the results of the election. What feeds you? Maybe it's the whole idea of working together toward common cause with folks you don't get to see that often, only at election time. Maybe it's a reaffirmation of your sense of values. Maybe it's something else entirely. Felix Adler, a humanist who founded the ethical culture movement, said that spirituality is consciousness of infinite interrelatedness. It is in this way that working for justice is a social, spiritual practice. It increases our awareness of the interrelatedness of all people and the interdependence of all life. That's what the boys in our story learned, that abusing ravens was abusing our relationships. The raven might be seen as a metaphor for the whole natural world. The story asks the question, are we in right relationship to nature? And implies that we should be. Praxis is the combination of action and reflection on your actions and what those actions mean to you. Especially when what you are doing is familiar and practiced, it is easy to forget what it means to you. I invite you to take some time during these next 5 or 6 weeks of the election to remind yourself why you go to all this work, to recall the values that undergird the reasons you engage in the democratic process so deeply, and to relish the relationships you both establish and renew as you go about phoning and strategizing and setting up signs. Your work will probably not look any different to an outside observer, but you may see it a touch differently this time around. No one can do all the work that needs doing. Intimate interaction with the election process is not for everyone. But each of us can help address one aspect of one issue. This seems obvious, but if you're casting around for something to do, the range of what needs doing can be daunting. Find the place, as Frederick Buechner says, the place where your deep passion and the world's deep hunger meet. Total immersion is not necessary. Start by signing a petition or going to the Gay Pride Parade, or by reading up on an issue beyond the newspapers. This is all a part of the process. As you are doing this work with intentionality, regularity, and depth, I invite you to remind yourself, and maybe those you work with, why you do what you do. Remind yourself what inspires you, what you are grateful for, what your passion is, and then how does this task make you come alive? Theologian and civil rights leader Howard Thurman says, "Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive." Amen.